Okay, this is the special live version of Truth Jihad Radio. Kevin Barrett here. I don't know about playing Dick Cheney as an intro every week. That guy sometimes starts to get on my nerves. In fact, he was getting on my nerves long ago, long before I started putting that quote into my radio bumper music. Anyway, we'll maybe have to redo that intro at some point, someday. That was from an interview with Cheney shortly after he stepped down. He said the highest moment of the 8 years of his vice presidency was 9/11. I'm sure it was. All right, let's get going with tonight's show. Steve Robertson is coming on in the first hour. Steve Robertson is one of the most interesting new additions, or relatively recent additions anyway, over at Veterans Today. Steve is the founder and CEO of Project Peace on Earth, and he is very active in mainstream entertainment. Well, yeah, pretty much. He's a filmmaker. He facilitates benefit concerts, including some big ones. Works with very well-known people. We'll get into some of that with him in just a moment. But I should also mention the second hour, Greg Felton, author of The Host and The Parasite, is coming on to discuss how Israel was really created, both Balfour-wise 100 years ago and in 1948 with the vicious genocidal ethnic cleansing that killed or chased out the vast majority of Palestinians. And this is still relevant because they want another big war in the Middle East. They're trying to hijack the American military to enable them to finish the job. Just like Hitler should have finished the job. Well, Ben-Gurion should have finished the job. A lot of even sort of supposedly liberal Israelis like Benny Morris talk about that. So if we don't want our country destroyed by these psychos who blew up the Trade Center, murdered 3,000 Americans and blew $6 trillion plus of American money, not to mention tons of American blood on their wars against their enemies over in the Middle East, it's time to say no. And I think both my guests tonight would pretty much agree with that. Anyway, let's get Steve Robertson on. Steve Robertson, again, is a fascinating guy, a renaissance man in the sense that he is working on many levels. He's working on red pill political issues, including Palestine, and telling the truth about Palestine is pretty much a red pill issue. And he's also very much in the world of big name mainstream entertainment. And what's more, spirituality. He's got a new book out called The Power of Choice, Success, and Your Life Purpose. This is amazing stuff. So I'm very privileged to welcome Steve Robertson. Welcome, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm well, Kevin. Thanks. How are you?
I'm well. And it's good to have you. You know, I've really enjoyed looking into your work in preparation for this interview. You know, I always try to look into people's work when I bring them on. And you're really working in a number of interesting areas, you know, across the board from, you know, politics to spirituality and beyond. And you're calling it just the way you see it, which is in many ways the way I see it politically. And that takes courage, man. I know people come after you when you talk honestly about some of these issues.
Well, I have I've been fortunate only in that I have a growing awareness, especially in the Los Angeles area. If you make the statement Palestine has beautiful flowers, you're labeled anti-Semitic. And or they say, well, why doesn't Israel have beautiful flowers? And this is just an unthought through, you know, paradox and how, you know, people have been trained to defend themselves. And I think, and rightfully so, for a level of guilt that they should likely feel and feel weighing upon them, and how they're so cruelly treating the Palestinian people. This is, as far as I'm concerned, this is unacceptable on my shift. No one builds a 30-foot prison wall around another country, and especially a birthplace of Jesus, if you will, supposedly. So,
yeah, and of course, being in that Hollywood media world where there's so much Zionist power, you know, like at all sorts of levels, including some of the deep state, you know, organized crime levels. Many people don't know that the model for the guy in The Godfather who left the horse's head in the bed was Mickey Cohen, the gangster out of L.A., worked for the Meyer Lansky Syndicate. And people like that, as well as some corrupt folks in our own government and some supposed super patriots from their perspective over in Israel, are behind all sorts of craziness, in my opinion. And I've been studying this for a while from, you know, elements, you know, they were a factor in the JFK assassination, major factor in 9/11. And I could go on, but you get the drift. But you bring that up and boy, a lot of folks just can't handle it. And it's not just the Zionists. It's, you know, the whole mainstream consensus.
I would agree. And there are a lot of, people that are unaware of Christian Zionists like Hagee and I call one of my home states Texas. You know, there's my first trip to Palestine. I was reviewing some sites for a large scale concert we were doing there, looking in both the Jerusalem area and in Palestine. And when I went over into the Palestinian border, as far there was a gentleman who was driving me around who was a ex-Israeli military person, and as we drove into the Palestinian region for the first time, all I could see as far as the eye could see were settlements, and these weren't the little rinky-dink makeshift tents that mainstream media has shown us that to be, you know, some poorly thinking settlers who are trying to set their stake in the ground. No, these were full-blown cities, 10,000-plus person cities, built Sun Tzu, Art of War, on top of a hillside. And as we drove past, I said, you know, with shock, I said, what's the deal with all of these settlements here? And he goes, you do know, by the way, that these are being occupied by American Jews. And I scratched my head and remained silent. I said, that is very peculiar. You know, went back the second time, and I was told that these were American Jews and that these were being funded by right-wing fundamentalist Christians like Hagee. And I scratched my head, and I thought, well, this is very odd. I grew up, you know, my father was a nuclear physicist and ran the aerospace program for TRW. And I lived in a little city called Friendswood, Texas, when I was around 7 or 8, and I was, this was a Quaker established city, and I was profoundly curious about the phenomena of what I was learning at that age, various derivations of Christianities, Methodists, Protestants, Catholics, etc. And then, of course, the Quakers. And they all seemed under their breath say, well, we have the right version of Jesus, and the Methodist or whoever, or the Presbyterians, they're basically going to hell. And I would always scratch my head as a little kid and ask, and no one could really give me a good answer. And then when it got to the Jewish people, it said, oh, and by the way, the Jews supposedly killed Jesus. And I said, oh, okay. And then when we got to this big subject of, you know, seeing that the right-wing fundamentalist Christians were funding these settlements in Palestine and populating them with American Jews, I said, this is the ultimate paradox. And I dug more deeply, and literally this is the sandbox mentality that's at charge here. They said, well, basically the way this plays out is the Christians believe that once they get the Jewish people into the Palestinian region, this is going to be a end of days. It's going to be a really good day for the Jewish people who convert, and for those who don't, it's going to be a bloodbath. And I thought to myself, well, that's not very sane thinking. And then I would ask a Jewish person, I said, well, this is what I understand repeating the same story. He says, you know, is that true? I said, and if so, why on earth would you be taking money from right-wing fundamentalist Christians who want to get you over into Palestine so that you can either convert to Christianity or die horribly? And they look at you just square in the eye and just say, we'll take money from these idiots all day. This is never going to happen. And that's, it was a real Santa Claus moment, for me. And,
Maybe you should explain that expression, because you just wrote a couple of articles about that.
I did. And, you know, the essence of that is, Kevin, I've always been curious. I am one of the few people in the world that spent an entire afternoon with Dr. Edward Bernays. Edward was the founding father of public relations. He was 97 at the time. Very kind and gracious person with me. Served me coffee and crumb cakes as we looked through photo albums of he and Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Kissinger, pretty much every major president since, you know, through the 40s.
Well, Bernays was one of the unacknowledged legislators of the world.
Mind control
doctors, spin doctors.
And he was nephew to Sigmund Freud. And I had the internet at that time when I met with him. I was probably in my late 20s. There was no internet at that time, so I had no way to research who he really was other than being a world-acclaimed expert. And I was interested on how you could use the knowledge of PR to facilitate world peace. And, you know, he was kind and generous with me, and I had no idea I was basically talking to one of the kingpins of the deep state, you know, of the Illuminati or whatever you want to call him, especially if you read my articles and you read his quotes. I mean, there's no question. You know, he was in charge and running the machine for a group of elite people who just basically saw the rest of humanity as some lower chasm of consciousness, and, you know, somewhat like most Gentiles do not know that they are referred to as goyim, which means cattle. That's what it means. They're chosen and you are cattle, and this is not acceptable. I mean, all people are God's children. All people are God's children. So,
to what extent do you think that the roots of the current problems of Zionism, both in Palestine and Zionist power around the world, are rooted in the Old Testament, the chosenness complex? I'm just about to publish a book by Laurent Guyonel called "From Yahweh to Zion," that traces these problems right back to the original Yahwist priesthood, which Laurent has a very dim view of. He thinks these guys were kind of, you know, the Edward Bernays characters of their time, and they hoodwinked their own people and essentially exploited their own people, became a superior caste, and they essentially terrorized their own people into hating other tribes, these goyim, these inferior tribes who worship false gods. And so you're supposed to go out and smash the other guy's gods and steal their stuff and give it to quote unquote Yahweh, which means actually giving it to the priesthood.
All right. Well, let me, if I can, before I answer that question, and circle back to this, what I call the Santa Claus effect. And the setup for this, again, growing up in this little small city of Friendswood, Texas, one year, you know, and I'm saying now from a 5-mile view, trying to understand this bigger picture of how these false flag operations can occur in plain sight for humanity and et cetera, and just trying to get to the root cause of this. I recall back when I was around 8, I was, you know, Christmas was, as we're about to celebrate, you know, one of the best times of the year, and that's when you get to put your list down, and I had been good, so I put the list down of things that I wanted to get from Santa Claus, and the rumor was that he would travel around the entire planet, land on every rooftop, you know, on the entire planet, deliver presents through the chimney, and then the following day you would wake up and find the gift that you had asked for. And, you know, as a little kid, you just take that story as rote. You don't even question how are the physics of that possible, and et cetera.
But it's sort of like with 9/11 demolitions.
How
could that guy get down the chimney?
Yeah, exactly. And that's a rabbit hole to go down as well. And so in this recent article I wrote, USA, Israel, Palestine, and the Santa Claus Effect on Veterans Today, I recount this phenomena. And about the time around Christmas when I was age 8, I saw my parents carrying some very large bags into their room. And the door was cracked open. I'm, of course, a curious little boy. I look through and I see them wrapping presents that I had clearly asked Santa Claus for, The following day under the tree, I noted those same packages were marked from Santa Claus, and there was no way that was possible. Yet that night before, my parents cleverly had put out cookies and milk for Santa Claus to eat and carrots and for the reindeer. And in the morning, the milk was gone. The cookies were mostly eaten and the carrots were gone, and clear proof and evidence that Santa Claus was there. And yet something didn't strike me at my gut as, you know, intuitively true.
Yeah, you must have been a budding conspiracy theorist.
I'm not sure about that, but it was just just something about me just said that there's something not true about this. So I asked a friend who was slightly older than me, you know, and I said this with a sense of reservation. I sort of knew his answer, but I didn't want to know his answer. And I said, well, look, is this Santa Claus thing real? And he looked at me like, oh, I was a dunce. And I just...
You really believe the official story?
Oh, gosh, yeah, Kevin. And because my dad was always, my mom and dad were always loving and very kind with me. I grew up in a Leave It to Beaver type of family. And when he told me that it was a lie, I basically, honestly, I felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach and I wanted to cry. I felt so violated and so wounded. And so this article that I wrote is basically the chronology of some major events, these false flag events, you know, the falsehoods we were told about Russia. The first thing on everyone Russian's mind is they're going to wake up and how can they do a preemptive strike on us because they hate our freedom. And you think to yourself, you scratch your head and go, why would they hate our freedom? That's dumb. And because it is dumb. They didn't hate our freedom. They loved our freedom. And many things like this. Out of the article, there's a particular story of note. Right around the time Mandela was released from prison and was thereafter elected as president, they visited a family in that area of, you know, upper middle class stature, and this BBC film crew wanted to take either the husband or the wife into this region where all these ghettos were. People were living in cardboard boxes and open latrines, you know, millions of people. And they had been told, as they repeated, to stay away from that place. Don't even go near it. You'll be pulled out of the car, raped, killed, murder, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the BBC crew released, got the wife to agree and signed a release that she would go with them. The husband was a coward, wouldn't go. And she and the BBC film crew drove up to this ultra ghetto. That's the only way I can describe it. And as the car pulls up, the people see that there are white people in the car, and they just pour out of the out of the ghetto and surround the car. And every face that you see is just beaming with happiness and joy. They get out. All they can do, they want to touch her. They want to touch everybody. And there was, as they continued to walk, no one said an unkind thing whatsoever. You son of a gun, look what you did to us. No one did that. And they walked across through the city, you know, open latrines, cardboard houses, you know, just rickety as you can expect. And they got to the edge of this clearing on the other side of the this city, if you could call it that. And the woman bent over, and she began to weep. And the news crew came up to her and said, well, what's going on? And she composed herself, and she said, it's all been a lie. It's all been a lie. And this Santa Claus effect is, it's very tough for us to come to the reality that we are at the butt end of a lie. The lie about 9/11, the lie about most of the wars we've been in, the lie about why our soldiers are in Afghanistan. It's like, not to protect our oil interests, not to bring freedom, but to protect poppy fields. And, you know, the criminal syndicate that's really running you know, Washington, D.C. I grew up in that area. I dated, you know, Walter Mondale's daughter. I knew, you know, Walter very, you know, well. His, I knew his son.
I think I voted for him for president once.
Yeah, but I knew Teddy very well, and I knew him through motocross racing, and that area is a real. I couldn't wait to get out on, you know, get away when I was racing motorcycles to get out of that area of Northern Virginia because it was just so tense. I didn't have a clue until I really read Richard Nixon's book. I convinced myself. My dad did work for Barry Goldwater, who I thought who seemed to be a good man. My father was always a good human being, though my dad did. My dad ran the aerospace program for TRW. My dad created fracking, or was one of the pioneers of it. They called it coal bed gasification at the time for TRW. My dad's the guy that bored the hole in the Yucca Mountain sites where they're proposing to store nuclear waste in stainless steel glass lined drums. I was very insulated from all that. I was just really at that time, I was interested in racing motorcycles and having, you know, having chasing girls. Like,
well, a lot of the people doing that stuff are perfectly nice people. My Uncle Bill was one of the two or three top guys they flew into Three Mile Island after that blew. He was a nuclear expert. And Uncle Bill was a great guy. You know, they're not necessarily bad people.
Yeah, my dad grew up dirt poor, literally dirt poor in Louisiana. He got a scholarship to go to Louisiana Tech, where I went to school, and he was a good and loving man. Much like, you know, I lived a Leave It to Beaver type life. I never saw my dad drink. I didn't see him smoke. You know, he'd have a beer now and then, and you know, he had an IQ off the Richter scale. You know, Mensa level IQ, but I had as much interest in academics and in world politics as I could flap my arms and fly to the moon until I got out of college. And I always said, well, look, I can just, you know, be a bit of a, you know, a fun guy and go out and race motorcycles and chase women and have a drink or two. And the smart guys have this figured out. And then I began to see, and I began to look in beyond paying attention to the stupid sports on TV, which are just major distractions. And I began to care about this world more deeply when I was, you know, my late 20s. And I said, these people I thought were smart, they definitely do not have this thing.
Was there any particular thing? Was there a particular Santa Claus moment?
It was just sort of a stack up moment. But another Santa Claus moment, I said, well, look, if there's anybody that understands geopolitics, it's probably Richard Nixon. He seemed to have a bad reputation, but he was known as an important strategist. And I decided to read his book, Real War. And I got about halfway through his book, and basically he made the resounding epiphany that he basically said the whole world is a chessboard, and this has to do with who's controlling certain strategic metals like chromium, titanium, platinum, metals of this sort, which the U.S. does not have on our soil or in very limited, to a very limited degree. And without these strategic metals, you cannot build intercontinental ballistic missiles or jet aircraft engines and, you know, needless to say, all the other resources, oil, water, gas, you know, et cetera. And I said, now I'm getting the picture here. And I, you know, began to understand that we had military bases around the world. And I later found out, you know, we've got over, you know, 1,000 military bases around the world. And, you know, everybody talks about Russia being the bad guy. Well, come on, you know, Russia's got, as I understand, 5 military bases, 4 of which are in the former USSR. Most of these countries like China and Russia are self-sufficient with these strategic resources. And we used our, and have historically used our military might to, force, you know, countries who have these resources, you know, for batteries and, you know, et cetera, to give us access to these. And we use, you know, high profile, Harvard, Ivy League educated economic hitmen to go into these countries, offer these countries very bad deals, bad deals, which we know are going to be upside down forever. By the time the contract is signed, the ink is not in black, it's in red. They're already upside down. And so
that's what John Perkins writes about in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I've had him on a couple of times.
Exactly. So this is it's a tough one to swallow, if you will, from a matrix perspective, the red pill, the pill of reality. Because I didn't want to. I believe that the commentators on network news, you know, from Walter Cronkite as sort of a model, you know, on through the rest of these, were just telling us the truth. And the reality is they're not. They're not telling us the truth. Everything and almost everything they tell you is a lie. They use the 70-30 rule. Give you 30% truth, 70%, you know, lie, and then you can... You know, you got the guy right after 9/11, just happens to be there on camera. Well, you know, how do you think this thing happened? This guy's like no expert. And he goes, oh, no, it could have been the plane, the jet fuel, you know, going down the building and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's the famous Harley guy, the guy on the Harley. He had the official story down perfectly, and he just recited it without even putting any emotion into it. Obviously, a bad actor reciting lines.
Look, bad actor. And look, I lived in the Washington D.C. area. I know if any plane ever got near the White House or the Pentagon, I mean, they were scrambling jets, and those planes were escorted or shot down. You know, the just sheer common sense of every nuance that you could possibly imagine relative to this story just reeks, you know, with a false flag. Because the bottom line is, it is. It is a false flag. It's the biggest one. And look, that whole operation, it served to, you know, Rumsfeld the day before said, you know, where, you know, he was asked, where's the $2 trillion that's missing? He shrugs his shoulders arrogantly and says, I don't know. And then boom, you know, the cruise missile, that's what I believe it was, that hit the Pentagon. Because look, jet planes, jet airliners, and I know a fair amount about this. The nose cone of these planes are made of fiberglass. That's where the radar system sits. And that plane penetrated roughly three walls of 8 feet concrete reinforced steel all the way to the center of the building. Just not possible. So, you know, and that area where the plane, this cruise missile struck, this happened to be the region where all of the accounting on that missing money was. So when you begin to look at this, you just scratch your head and you scratch your head and you scratch your head, and then you begin to pull your hair out and just go, no, there's no way. We are the good guys on the planet. And I must say, Kevin, we are not. We're the bad people. We're the cruel ones on the planet. I used to believe in my heart and soul that I believe the people of America are good people, but the people who are running our governments are just monsters. And you can trade.
To what extent might they justify their actions to themselves there are all sorts of stories they must be telling to themselves. A noble lie, for example, like Santa Claus is a benevolent lie to try to keep children happy. And 9/11 and all these other lies, they probably think,
the 9/11, you know, the 9/11,
if we don't tell these, how are we going to dominate the world? And how are all the American people going to be fat and happy and naive and good people?
I boil, Kevin, the bottom line of 9/11 served one thing, whatever with the $2 trillion, whatever with that. That event served as one single thing. It turned the light switch from the government, you know, on from being the government being accountable to the people. And in one fell switch, it pushed the light switch in the off position where the people were now accountable to the government. Mm-hmm. And if you watch around the country, all these videos of police officers, especially on Facebook, where you can still find that sort of stuff, where police officers are just using a normal encounter with a regular citizen who's talking calmly and rationally, and they escalate these conversations into just a full-blown cage fighting event where these people are hurt, tasered, and or murdered. This is just crazy. And if you read my article in Veterans Today on U.S. police brutality towards its own citizen, you will see, bottom line, it comes from one place, Israel. And our U.S. police force are being taken to Israel and being trained in live theater with the Palestinians to treat these people as cruel and dogmatically as you possibly could imagine.
So they're turning the American underclass into Palestinians.
Oh, exactly. And they come back and they're trained that to believe that our citizens are now terrorists. It's not your part of our community. And it's not like, hey, Joe, what's going on here? How come you're so upset? And, you know, let's talk about this a little bit. Did you have something going on, or is your family okay? Just having sort of a Mayberry RFT moment where I believe police officers were, and I do believe I would hope most police officers are good people and do really care. And that's why they got into that position. It's not so, hey, I'm just angry as hell, and the first person that says something, I'm just going to knock their clock out. And it really does appear that there are just too many of these situations occurring. And so if I may, just take a pause for a moment and say that I really do believe in my heart and soul. I read the Bible cover to cover three times before I was age 18, and I've studied a lot of major religions around the world, Sufism, Native American, Confucius, et cetera. And I've really boiled it down to this, Kevin. I believe to date, and please, listeners, just hear me all the way through and think through this with me before reacting. I believe every monstrous, horrible, horrific thing to date is really occurring, because people are literally, and I do mean literally, doing exactly what Jesus said in his quote, "Love thy neighbor as thyself." And that is the whole problem. We are loving our neighbors exactly how we love ourselves. And that is that we love ourselves horribly. So until I can find kindness and care and compassion for myself, I'm only going to project my craziness onto you.
So you think the Zionists maybe are hating on Palestinians because ultimately the Zionists themselves are self-hating Jews?
Well, look, we all unfortunately tend to be self-hating to some degree or another. Some of us were fortunate, as I believe I was, to have parents who were kind and loving and caring and nurturing, and saw what they were doing as, with every thought, word, and action and gesture, nurturing me into becoming a whole and loving and kind and caring man. Other people weren't fortunate like that. Other people may have had parents who were alcoholics or abusive or hurtful, or looked at you and said, when you proclaim for the first time what you really wanted to be, a doctor or whatever, a lawyer or go to college one day or whatever, and they looked at you like you were just a dummy and go, there's no way you're ever doing that. And people forget that our parents, we as children see our parents as the God figures. They are our creators. And when they make these statements, that the only thing we can do is take that to truth as gospel. And so we live in this paradox where we go, no, something in my heart really tells me I want to achieve this. And yet my parent, the God creator, told me I can't. And so they live in that state of inner war with themselves. And so, look, Buddha said, from a reality perspective, Buddha said, all that we are is a result of what we have thought. And King Solomon in the Bible said, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. The word man, as you know, is a Sanskrit word. It means consciousness, not male, flesh, and bone. So this creates an entirely different inflection on this quote, man was created in the image of God. So it means our consciousness was created in the image of God.
And that's probably literally true, since the universe is primarily consciousness. This matter, space, and time, the material world we live in, is an illusion that's created by this deeper level of consciousness.
Look, the Jesus figure, if you take that, if there was such a figure, the Jesus figure said, greater things I have done, and even the least among you can do greater than I. I mean, how else can you interpret that other than I did it, and you can do it, and you can go further than I?
Well, that's what I always thought. But that's the only way Christianity ever made sense to me. But the Christians I talked to, they seem to put Jesus up on a pedestal and say that it was his sacrifice that was the issue.
Yeah, but then he said, in order to do that, you must first find the kingdom of heaven that dwelleth within. And then he later says, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven until ye become as a child. So in other words, only in this sort of metaphorical state of innocence can we, as it says in Psalms, be still and know that I am God. And only then can you know, and God said, let there be light. And at that the word in the Bible actually means primary harmony. That's what it actually means. And the word was made flesh and full of grace and dwelt among us, which is why Einstein states energy and mass are different forms of the same thing. If anyone disagrees with anything that I'm saying here, look around the room you're sitting in right now. Look, let your eye cast on anything, the computer, the TV, the wall, the building you're in, chair you're sitting on, etc. All of this isn't magic. These were thoughts, period, the end. And we are thinking from the light switch in the off position based on fear and distrust. And we could be co-creating from the light switch in the on position where we're loving and we're kind with ourselves. And the only thing I see in your eyes, Kevin, or in the eyes of any person I make contact with is you are my brother. You are my sister. You are my children. And in the eyes of the animals, these are God's creations. I'm only here to take care of them and with Mother Earth, you know, to look into the eyes of Mother Earth. So, you know, I've done most of my work in this Palestinian region. I have done some very interesting events. I produced recently an album with Peter Gabriel and Roger Waters and Stuart Copeland from The Police and Philip Lawrence from Bruno Mars. And, you know, just some of the most nice, kind, cool, aware people you could ever
meet. Are any of those guys ready to come out for 9/11 Truth, preferably on my radio show?
Hey, look, I can't speak for them. I don't know. And I don't know to what degree they're aware of it. But I can tell you from the stuff I've watched on 9/11 and foreign perspectives on it, they look at us like we are they look at the American public like we are the ultimate dunces, that this is so obvious to them.
Yeah, that's what they tell me when I lecture on 9/11 in places like Morocco and Turkey, especially. Well, they say, go back to America and tell your countrymen this. We already know it.
Yeah, this is just too common sense. So, you know, I focused on this Palestinian region because I saw this place as the birthplace of the three major monotheistic religions. This is the birthplace of the crazy psychology and I've got the right God, so you don't. So that must make me good. And if I'm good, you got to be bad. And if I'm good and you're bad, I must be righteous and you must be evil. And
wait a minute, Steve. Palestine has been administered by Muslims almost since Islam existed. And sure, there was a conquest, but that conquest was supported by a lot of the people there because the Byzantines were so corrupt and so fanatical. They were persecuting all these other sects of Christians and really persecuting Jews. So the Muslims had a lot of help. And most of the time the Muslims have been administering the Holy Land, they've been pretty open-minded about protecting the rights of the Jews and the Christians to worship the way they see fit. In Islam, convert people.
Look, I can tell you when I did, you know, a concert, the first concert I've worked on for 20 years, and I pulled that off in Bethlehem on Christmas Day of 2011 out to 80 million homes. You know, I brought in the lead singer from the group Enigma, Fox Lima, and Joanne Shenandoah, Grammy-winning Native American singer, and Gary Nicholson, Grammy-winning Texas Hall of Fame singer, and Hani Nasser, and Peter Joseph, who did the important film Zeitgeist, the movie. We produced a video, six-minute video, and we showed how, and through that video, how Jesus and Buddha and Krishna and Muhammad were basically all saying the same thing, and Jewish rabbis were all saying the same thing, just be loving. And I promise the Palestinian government, the magistrates of the religious orders there, not one single person ever suggested, you know, that we censor, that they censor anything that we were trying to communicate. And I basically, as best if I may say, I threw the metaphysical kitchen sink at this thing. And we had Joanne Shenandoah's, remind the Palestinians and the world that the Native Americans think seven generations ahead about how we treat resources and such. And we did the prayer. She did the prayer, let nothing be done to harm the children, which is the first thing you do when you go into a sweat lodge, which represents the womb of Mother Earth, where you go to die and be born again. So, look, that region is just, I'm just meaning birthplace-wise, this is the paradigm of this crazy psychology. I got the right God. You don't. I'm good, you're bad, I'm righteous, you're evil. And once I got you at evil, I can go into your village and murder men, rape women, kill babies, and burn the village down and go home and sleep like a baby because God said it was okay. And I just said to myself, this is nuts.
But wait a minute. It's the Zionist leadership has always been arch-secularist, not religious.
Yeah. Well, can't really.
Maybe arch-secularism can be just as fanatical a religion as any of the traditional religions.
Look, I think anytime we move into a, anytime someone can say as some Zionist or Jewish people say, we're the chosen ones. I can only say one thing kind about that, BS. Or the Christians, they say, we found the way. Not a way, but the way. This is just insane rhetoric that just indicates someone has not thought through. Because if they take the time to read these other texts, as I've done, they're going to find that the message is very common and very central, and that is just be loving with yourself and be loving with other people. That's really the truth. People, we always have fanatics who can misinterpret this and say, well, God justifies us being able to do this to these other people. No, the true God is only a God of love. That's really the truth. And that was the ultra Santa Claus moment that I had was to come to that pathway of discovery through, just a passionate heart and soul look at trying to understand world religious teachings and spiritual teachings. Because otherwise, if it's not, please, God, I pray right now, eject me off this planet because this is an insane asylum. Mm-hmm. And I wish not to be on one.
Yeah.
I wish to help on to whatever degree I possibly can to help people be sane and kind and loving and caring and really honor each other and have reverence for Mother Earth and for have reverence for all the sentient beings that make up this planet that have a right, to consume and breathe air and to take in food and to give life and birth. And when we can see things in this more holographic perspective rather than a linear war type model. We're the righteous ones and they're the bad ones and let's kill them, which is how we thought. And I used to think like Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly and carry a big stick. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3", man. I played football. I was a linebacker, defensive end. I used to love to crush people. As a fullback, I didn't run around people. I ran over the top of people. I wanted to punish them. And it wasn't until I was about in my late 20s, I really discovered when I had sort of a spiritual meltdown around my job and my girlfriend, I really started to look really within. And I said, look, I can defeat physically most men and mentally most men, but that's not true power. A true power is a man being kind and loving and caring and compassionate. That's authentic power. And I promised to myself that I would try to live as that example as best I possibly could. I am human and I make mistakes. And look, I did these events in Palestine. The first one I did was called Free All, Love All. We brought my friend John Quigley and I, one of our PPO, Project Peace on Earth, members, we brought 1,000 Palestinian refugee children to the base of the Mount of Temptation, where Jesus supposedly stayed for 40 days and 40 nights, and we had the children form the image of the Picasso Peace Dove and then spell the words love all.
That's such a beautiful project, Steve.
Yeah. And then we had them spell the word love in Arabic, and we filmed the image aerially. And a year later, the UN selected this as one of the 49 most iconic images in the history of the UN out of some 800,000 photos. We didn't even know such some sort of award like that was even in the cards. And then we did the next event, John and I did, called Free All, where we had several hundred Palestinian Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts put their paint-covered hands on the dividing wall in Bethlehem that marks the original road into Bethlehem. There's a 30-foot prison wall around Palestine. Most people are clueless about this. And Gaza, by the way, is solitary confinement within this. So we had them
put and when Israelis actually go in there, like Miko Peled, whose father was a great general and a hero, an Israeli hero in the 67 war, Miko Peled started to wake up, and he finally decided to go over and talk to some Palestinians, and he had that same kind of Santa Claus moment that South African woman did that you were describing. I've been lied to. Nice people.
He did. And look, you know, when we did this next event, we had the kids put their paint-covered hands on the dividing wall in Bethlehem. That marked the original road into Bethlehem under Israeli control. There's a Israeli gun conning tower there with soldiers in it, bulletproof glass. And I did the Native American Ho'oponopono with a eagle feather and sage on the wall before we did it. I'm sorry, please forgive me. Thank you, I love you. And we had the kids. First time those kids had ever touched that wall, and it wasn't about 6 days before that, there had been a militant had detonated a bomb on that wall, right on that conning tower, and there was a shoot to kill order. And we had to negotiate all that. And when we did this image, we had the rest of the kids spell the words free all as the other kids were putting their paint covered hands as a permanent mark to bring the wall down. I was told I couldn't see it, but I was told it was the first time the guards in that conning tower ever opened up the bulletproof glass, and they were leaning out and looking over, this experience that was happening just below them. And then the next event we did in was a worldwide concert, a sort of a live concert with John Anderson from Yes and Serge Tankian from System of a Down and Stuart Copeland and a whole bunch of musicians. And that was and people like Gary Zukav and Carolyn Mace, other thought leaders, called Forgive All. So we did first event, we did Love All, then we did Free All. We had these kids, in front of the dividing wall spelling the words Free All. And then we did Forgive All. And then the last album I did was called To Unite All. So, probably makes sense to people. Love All, Free All, Forgive All, To Unite All. So I'm not looking to take I'm only looking to take a position of what I'm for. And what I am for is a world of love and kindness and peace and compassion. That's what I'm really for. I'm not against.
This reminds me of Sufism. You mentioned you studied Sufism.
Yeah, it might be most of the teachings. Be they Christian or Jewish teachings. These principles are inherent, but we forget these things, and that's part of the Santa Claus moment, is that when you read, the real truth of these texts, you have that moment. Well, why are we doing these crazy things towards these other people when our book says be loving? And you can't, and then somebody goes, well, they did they did this, that, and the other, and so therefore, and you can begin, once you go down the rabbit hole of rationalizing things and not just looking at the pure innocence and clarity of truth, you're lost. You're in the Santa Claus moment. You took the blue pill. You didn't wake up. You stayed asleep. You stayed in the state of suffering. And, it takes responsibility. It takes clarity. It takes being, in my opinion, a real man. A real man doesn't watch and memorize stupid sports statistics, whatever. Tell me the real statistics as a man. How many children go to bed every single night without, a good meal or clean drinking water or fear for their life or being exploited by these monstrous pedophilia rings that are around the world, which I hope somebody has enough kahunas, you know, to address. Because I tell you one thing, the end, not on my shift.
Isn't that like the kind of the extreme example of this problem of not caring about other people's kids? I mean, we all care about our kids, except for maybe few super psychopaths. But do you
see other people as cattle?
Yeah.
You know, whatever. You know, it's a bug under the foot. It doesn't matter. Some of the texts I've read are just, you know, if you were to read what some of these texts say about Jesus being in hell in a boiling vat of horribleness, or what Mother Mary is, it's just, I mean, it makes you want to
be sick.
You're
talking about the Talmud.
Yeah, I'm talking about.
Isn't that strange that somehow the American Christians, people have been brainwashed into thinking the Muslims hate Jesus and Christians, and it's not the Muslims. The Muslims love Jesus and love Mother Mary and have a positive attitude towards Christians.
How could you not love, you know, these figures, you know, people who were kind and compassionate? Did they, you know, when in the story, if so true with Jesus, when the woman was being stoned, he didn't raise his voice. He didn't say, "You crazy son of a guns, you know, what do you think you're doing stoning this woman?" With kindness and care and love and clarity, he said, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." And they had to drop that hot rock of illusion. They had to drop that hot rock because the truth was too clear and piercing. And when you look at the great sages around the world, I mean, they have these truths. There's not a great sage on the planet who would ever suggest on any level to harm a hair on another person's head or ever look into another person's eyes, but with only love and care and compassion. And so I'm walking a razor's edge here, man. I'm looking to do events which I hope raise through sacred music, you know, the consciousness of people from various sacred sites. That's what we do at Project Peace on Earth. And at the same time, I'm like Gladiator, shield and sword, not on my shift. You know, and I do hope that these people, my prayer is that these people who are doing, you know, the most monstrous thing on the planet, the most cruel and indifferent things that they could ever do. By the way, my dear friend Jerry Jampolsky, one of the pioneers of the human potential movement, said, I remember, marked me very clearly, he said, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. So when we don't care about another human being or another animal or the environment, our environment, I mean, we can only exploit it for whatever physical gain we might feel we could have in that moment, or financial gain or egotistical gain we have. And so the larger picture that's at hand for, I hope, listeners here is that, you know, begin with yourself. You know, if you want to be the change, as Gandhi says, be the change of peace in your own heart. Take time in the morning to slow your mind down before you talk to anyone. Turn the TV on, turn the computer on, meditate.
And I'm sure people could find a lot more along those lines in your book, The Power of Choice, Success in Your Life Purpose.
They can.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there for tonight, but I'd love to have you back on, Steve. I'm so happy to welcome you to Veterans Today. You're doing incredible work. God bless you, and look forward to more down the line.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I really appreciate your kindness and having me on. Thank you.
Okay, here. That's Steve Robertson, founder and CEO of ProjectPeaceOnEarth.org. Amazing stuff. Check out the links at Truth Jihad Radio. Just go to truthjihad.com, click on the radio link. We'll be back next hour with Greg Felton. He's the author of The Host and the Parasite, talking about how Israel was really created. Welcome back. This is the second hour of tonight's live Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth from the website truthjihad.com. Please spread that around, because Google won't. They're working very hard trying to come up with algorithms to hide everything I do and everything everybody does who's not part of the corporate-controlled mainstream, putting out the monologue of the unipolar world order. So we're talking back to them, and I'm glad you're listening. Help somebody else listen. Spread the word. This is Revolution Radio, by the way, the greatest listener-supported network ever. Please do go to freedomslips.com, if you're not already there, and kick in a couple of smackaroos, or whatever you call the currency units that you might wish to throw at the coffers of Revolution Radio. Because it is, in fact, listener-supported, like me, Kevin Barrett of truthjihad.com. We can call it exactly the way we see it, because we're not dependent on big corporations, foundations, governments, or other evil institutions. Our listeners keep us going. It's the best way to do it. Okay, let's move on here. We've got another great guest coming in here tonight. That's Greg Felton. Greg is the author of The Host and the Parasite. It's coming out in a new edition. Okay, I know some people don't like that title. It's a little medical, but Greg's a great guy, and he can talk as well as write. I love authors who are also good speakers, and I think Greg qualifies. That's why I like to bring him on every now and then. And this time, he's going to be talking about, well, the foundation of Israel, and the Balfour Declaration centenary was full of hoopla and typical mainstream obfuscation and mendacity. The story you were getting in the mainstream was heavily redacted. The deep, dark, dirty truth about Israel is something that you're just never going to find in the mainstream. There are reasons for that, and we'll get going there with the discussion. I'll let Greg talk about that. So let's see if we can get Greg on here. Ooh, I'm getting one of those nasty messages that suggest that there may be a problem with his version of Skype or something like that. And I'm sure I'll hear something if he shows up. Oh,
can you hear me?
Hey, Greg, you're there. How's it going?
Oh, great now.
Okay. Yeah, we just missed half the show. The poor listeners had to suffer through a half-hour monologue.
Do you want to reschedule?
Well, no, we're on the air. You're live.
Oh, I'm live because our connection was dead for so long. That's interesting.
Yeah, I guess we had to reset the network connection or something like that. I'm going to have to straighten this out with Revolution Radio, though, before next week, because this has been happening over and over and over, and it's very frustrating.
Yeah, I know. When I got the message, I thought, my God, Kevin can't have that old a Skype network.
Yeah, it sounds like this kind of problem has happened quite often with people with smartphones. One more reason not to have a smartphone. Were you trying to use a smartphone?
I am on a, well, so-called smartphone, a less educated smartphone. But
I think they're all idiots.
So old, the Skype doesn't work on it. So I have to use my cell phone for Skype. And I had a very good interview last time with you and with my agent. And so I've never had a problem like this before.
Okay. Well, hopefully we won't have a problem like this again. So now we have half an hour instead of a full hour to discuss your article about how Israel was really created. Your title, I thought, was a little vague here. Anniversaries of major public events promote political interests, not the public spirit.
It wasn't my favorite headline. It was a little. I was kind of struggling to come up with something that didn't give it away.
Ah, okay.
I want to write about.
You're writing clickbait. You want people to say, "What the heck? What the bleep could this possibly be about?" And they click on it just to find out.
Well, yeah, again, I was accidentally very witty trying to get them to figure out what I was trying to get at. But the point is that the Balfour Declaration, which has been the subject of much propaganda, both for and against, has been blown out of proportion, I think. And there are things that are more important to the creation of Israel. The Balfour Declaration was really sort of a sycophantic love letter between the British government and the Zionist Federation in England. And it said, yes, the Her Majesty government looks very kindly upon the establishment of a Jewish homeland for the Jews, blah, blah, woof, woof.
But yeah, so really there's no legal force in that.
Say again?
There's no legal force in that document.
It has no legal force at all. Matter of fact, it was just a private letter from James Arthur Balfour, who was David Lloyd George's foreign secretary, to Lord Rothschild on behalf of the Zionist Federation. It was a private letter. It had no force of law, no nothing. It did indicate Judeophilic prejudice on behalf of Israel, on behalf of the British toward Palestine. But what's kind of weird is that the Balfour Declaration stated that no harm should come to the non-Jewish people of Palestine. And of course, that was abrogated immediately, which means either the British were willfully complicit in a future genocide, or they just didn't know what the hell they were doing.
And I think it's some combination thereof.
The British really aren't the smartest people in foreign affairs. I mean, they're the ones who put the
Saudis. Wait a minute, Greg. They took over the world. They're on this little tiny island out there in the Atlantic off the northwest fringe of Eurasia, and they took over the whole world. They can't be that stupid.
No, they're not stupid. I didn't say they're very stupid diplomatically. Militarily, they can conquer a lot of the world. But the British in the 19th century blundered diplomatically and allowed situations to develop that led ultimately to World War I. The British mishandled Palestine. They mishandled India. They mishandled a lot of things. They got out of Saudi Arabia in 1932, and after which the Americans moved in because the Americans told the Saudis, well, we'll let you keep all the oil revenue. We won't force you to give any money to your people in the way of education or health services. The British are very smug, very self-centered, and very unsophisticated in matters that concern the world.
Compared to U.S. Americans, I thought the British were more sophisticated than they think they're more sophisticated than the U.S. Americans.
Well, there aren't many people less sophisticated than the Americans. but the British didn't. The British attitude in Palestine was born of a prejudice that had no basis in reality. The British looked favorably upon the Jews, the establishment of a Jewish homeland, for one of two reasons. One, they found some sort of affinity with the Jewish mentality, or they were anti-Jewish and wanted to export all their British Jews to some other part of the world.
So they either loved
and
Jews
so much.
And the anti-Jewish
sentiment cannot be underestimated. Say again?
They either loved Jews so much that they wanted to give them the Holy Land, or they hated Jews so much they wanted to get them the heck out of Britain and send them off to the Holy Land.
Well, both points of view can be read into it. I mean, there's no excuse for the letter's contents because it was simply at variance with reality. It was a fan letter, and as such, really doesn't reflect the way the Zionist lobby worked in Great Britain.
But wait a minute, Greg. Doesn't the Balfour Declaration or the letter reflect a sort of a behind-the-scenes quid pro quo in which the British government had been negotiating with the Rothschilds family? They'd been approached with this proposition that, you know, we can win World War I for you. You just have to give us Palestine, and we can bring the U.S. into the war on your side and win it for you, bust up the Ottoman Empire, and you just have to give us Palestine. I mean, that was obviously the quid pro quo, wasn't it?
I've never seen that argument. I mean, I've seen a lot of commentary about the Rothschilds and how they're behind everything that goes on in the Middle East, but I've never seen any tangible proof of it. Now, the British, they might have had some arrangement with Rothschild, but I don't know. But nothing like that is in the document itself.
Well,
now, to the extent
not.
That the document reflects British prejudice in favor of the Zionists, well, even if that were true, I mean, it took something like 28 more years before this came to 30 years before it came to fruition. 31 years. My math's not so good. But it was in May 15th, 1948. And when Ben-Gurion declared statehood, the British had arbitrarily ended its mandate over Palestine, causing President Harry Truman great discomfort, because he was thinking of rescinding his support for Israel to set up a trusteeship so there could be some law and order so that the Palestinians wouldn't be massacred, which is exactly what happened. And speaking
right.
of that, I should like the readers to know that my book, The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America, and frankly England, is in a third edition. And it looks at the Obama and Trump years and puts them on the same continuum of Zionist occupation of the United States. And that's at thehostandtheparasite.com. So whatever.
Oh, wait a minute.
Book,
so how new is this? How new is this new edition?
This has just come out this year. It's just come out in the last couple of months.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that's kind of a classic. It's been through several editions.
This is the third edition. The first one was very badly edited, and I had to redo it. The second one was much better, and this one is up to date. That is to say, it takes the second edition ended with George W. Bush, and I didn't go into Obama because I didn't see that much difference, and frankly, there wasn't a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. But Donald Trump has been caricatured as some sort of beginning of the end of the United States, and that's simply untrue. He belongs on the same continuum as Obama, as Bush. So I thought it was time to reevaluate my view of Barack Obama and put him in the context of post-Bush America, which includes Donald Trump, because the Clinton Obama years are directly responsible for what is happening under Donald Trump.
Okay, in what sense? Because it seems to me that right now we're seeing a big reversal. And Obama had this policy of keeping a lid on the Zionist desire to create a big war in the region by going after Iran. This was part of the seven countries in 5 years plan that 9/11 was designed to launch. And so the Bush administration was on board with that. Cheney desperately tried to get the big war with Iran going. He even stole nuclear weapons from Maidan Air Force Base. But the good guys or the not so bad guys in the military stopped that from happening. Gwyneth Todd over in Bahrain stopped a big false flag that was going to, you know, kill a lot of American sailors, get blamed on Iran's allies from Bahrain, and launch this big war in Iran. So the 9/11 perps, the neocon hardcore Zionists, have been trying to finish the job and get this huge war going, punish the heck out of Iran since 2001, really. And the Bush-Cheney people just couldn't quite get it done because of pushback within their own military. Obama then sided with the people keeping a lid on the neocons. Obama hated Netanyahu, and the feeling was mutual. Netanyahu's still pushing for that big war with Iran. Obama keeps a lid on it for the full 8 years and even pushes through the Iran nuclear agreement, signifying the U.S. making nice with Iran, which drove Netanyahu crazy. But Trump, with his son-in-law Kushner, a friend of Kissinger, a Zionist organized crime figure, he's now part of this cabal, including bin Salman of Saudi Arabia and Netanyahu, who are pushing for the big war on Iran and Iran's friends in the region. So I see a huge change here with the Trump administration.
Well, there is. See, don't forget, though, you see, that Obama was not supposed to win the 2008 presidency. That was supposed to be Hillary Clinton. And under the Obama regime, yes, you're quite right, that he did keep a lid on the rabid Zionists, but it was Hillary Clinton who was responsible for the destruction of Libya at the behest of the Zionists. Obama didn't really have the character or the strength to stand up to the Zionists at all times. So when I look at Obama, I look at the Clinton years, and I look at Obama and Clinton as being two sides of the Israeli question. By the time Donald Trump comes into power, during the campaign, you will remember, he spoke vigorously against these wars of destruction that were bringing ruin to the United States. And he did this repeatedly, which is why he looked like he might not be such a bad guy. Of course, soon after he gets elected, he changes his tune. And this is because he was co-opted by the same deep state Zionist Democrats and Republicans that had been responsible for the Libya destruction. Trump doesn't have any real beliefs. He has a bunch of gut feelings and prejudices, but he doesn't really have any convictions.
But he has business interests, and he has organized crime figures surrounding him.
Well, he does, but then again, most Zionists are organized crime figures, too.
Yes.
But they're just not really called that because it's just not polite in our society. Mm-hmm. The problem is, you look at the people, look what happened to Trump when he decided to bomb Syria, attack Syria illegally. That was the first time after that the media in the United States had anything good to say about him. See, Trump, when he tries to hold the line against war and so forth, he's viciously attacked. Trump is a caricature, and that makes the attacks very easy. The fact that he is now trying to renegotiate NAFTA, trying to renegotiate or throw out the Iranian treaty, the nuclear treaty, nuclear agreement, is that, A, he's prejudiced against agreements that aren't 100% in America's favor, and he's being pressured by the Zionists. Now, I don't know how much influence Jared Kushner has or whether he's just like the Jethro Clampett of the Beverly Hillbillies that we have in Washington. But the notion that Trump is entirely different from the Obama regimes, I think, is a little mistaken. There is now an accentuation of the Zionization of America, which puts him on the same continuum as Obama and George W. Bush, which means we cannot look at Donald Trump as the beginning of the end of American fascism. Because in my book, I show there are seven stages now of Zionization of America. And Donald Trump, to a large extent, represents the final stage so far.
Well, wait a minute, Greg. Couldn't we say that there's a deep state in the United States and in other countries, and the U.S.-American deep state is becoming increasingly Zionist, as are elements of the surface state as well. And this process is happening regardless of who happens to be in the Oval Office.
That's true. But right now, the myth of Zion, the myth of Israeli virtue, the myth of Israel as a democracy, the myth of Palestinians as terrorists has become thoroughly exploded. It's not defensible. And because of that, there is nothing Israel can say that can cast itself in a good light. So it has resorted to essentially accepting, all right, we're the villains, we're sadistic, we're neo-fascist bastards, we're going to continue, and we defy you to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. So the Zionists under Trump have become, so they've had to become blatant. They've had to stop pretending they're anything other than what they are.
Which no more Mr. Nice Guy.
And you can compare this to the ridiculous charade that was played out in the 1990s under the misdirection of Bill Clinton. Now, he said to Yasser Arafat, "Yasser, we're not going to blame you if this goes south. We wouldn't do that." Well, he did. Because Clinton had been bought off by the Israel lobby before he was sworn in. So right
yeah,
now...
Yeah, well, but didn't they have to bring in Monica Lewinsky to kind of pressure him so that he wouldn't lean too hard on Israel in those negotiations? I mean, Clinton, didn't he want to get a Middle East peace? And wasn't he willing to push Israel to withdraw from most of its 1967 stolen territory? And wasn't that whole thing sabotaged through Monica Lewinsky?
I don't know enough about the Lewinsky-Mossad's caper, but I'm going to take it at face value that you're right. But even before he was sworn in, before Lewinsky just started doing what she did, Clinton had sold himself out to the lobby because he had promised them X number of million or billion dollars in aid before he was sworn in, before it was even approved by Congress. Mm-hmm. So clearly, I call him the first Jewish president of the United States.
Well, of course, that's one of the reasons
like one.
That he beat Bush. H.W. Bush had suddenly gotten into the bad graces of the Zionist lobby because he was selling AWACS to Saudi Arabia, and he was talking about pressuring the Zionists to give up their ill-gotten gains. And so Clinton became their man. And a lot of folks would say that's why H.W. Bush was a one-term president.
Well, that's exactly right. As a matter of fact, when Bush told Yitzhak Shamir, World War II terrorist, to get his ass over to Madrid to negotiate a permanent settlement with Palestine, the Zionist lobby led by Richard Perl wrote a condemnatory, almost libelous attack against Bush in the New York Times. And of course, Bush was called the worst friend Israel had ever had or some such thing. Because that was the moment that Bush lost the lobby. He lost the support of the deep state. And you're right. This is why Clinton got elected. And this is why, frankly, the Democratic Party is the worst party in the United States. I mean, the Republicans are so obviously stupid. They're obviously unqualified. And they can be mocked and ridiculed and held up to scorn, held up to ridicule. But the Democrats masquerade as humanitarians. They masquerade as populists. They masquerade as American firsters, and they're not. Mm-hmm. And this is why Hillary Clinton lost the election because Americans realized that she had nothing to say to them. And this is what John Podesta, her campaign manager, admitted in a private email. Clinton had no use for the American public. She had no connection to their lives, didn't consider them. She was only interested in serving bankers and Zionists and arms dealers and big pharma. She was a corporate android. She was barely human.
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think the Democrats are really more reflective of the sort of elite pseudo-religion of what shall we call it, progressivist secular humanism with its sacred cows of everything from the Holocaust to, you know, transgender rights and all of this. There's a kind of an anti-religious religious fanaticism that I mentioned earlier in the show when I had to do my monologue. And the Democrats are more the voice of the official orthodoxy of this new secular pseudo-religion, whereas Republicans pretend to hark back to traditional values and such. Of course, they don't. They're even more corrupt than the Democrats. As Gordon Duff often says, he says, you know, I do tend to prefer the Democrats to the Republicans because, you know, at least the Democrats prey on grown women for the most part.
Well, I don't know. I don't know to what degree religion has much to do with it.
No, religion has to do with everything, right? I mean,
religion is it non-ecclesiastical, much of it having to do with politics and economics and other things.
Well, religion is the kind of narrative, mythological basis of everything. It's all these assumptions, the key assumptions that we have about the world, the values that drive us to behave the way we do, and especially you can kind of identify the specifically religious aspect of this through the sacred cows and the taboos.
Well, I don't know. I don't think, see, the word values is one word I don't like very much because it's so undefined. It's just a generic abstract noun that talks about things people believe, but it's never defined in such a way as to distinguish one person from another.
Well, it's one of those things that you only can define by its absence. In other words, it only, just like black only exists as the exact opposite to, you know, white, in a sense, values mean something because we live in a world in which people who are value neutral or they claim to be value neutral or value free in their approach, which is mainstream science. This scientific enterprise is based on value neutrality. They don't care whether it's good or bad. They just want to see how it works. And therefore, the term values really does matter. Decide, you know, if you like the feeling of a lukewarm stove better than a really hot stove when you touch it, as Robert Persig of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance says, you've got values built right in to your very being. And you know that that stove that doesn't burn the crap out of you is of higher value to you than the stove that does.
Well, okay, hold on. We should have a whole show talking about this. I think this would be really a lot of fun.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't really buy that last argument because it seems to be sort of an extreme example. When I talk, you're right about one thing, that science is value neutral, or it's supposed to be. And unfortunately, there are many aspects of our human world that have been subsumed under the rubric of scientific behavior. But I don't think this has anything to do with religion, per se, as it has to do with orthodoxy in general. There's a religious mentality, for example, to the way the United States approaches economics. It's actually what I call econotheology.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
You have every aspect of a typical religion. You have a God, which you have, which is self-interest. You have prophets like Adam Smith, Milton Friedman. You have certain holy books, and it's not criticizable.
You have heretics like Karl Marx.
Well, Karl Marx is not a great economist. He was a good critic of the Western world, and I think he had some very valuable things to say. But the idea of the state withering away and dying was never quite defensible, and he misjudged the allegiance of working-class people in Europe. However, there's a way to look at that in a different way, because he is being proven right in an odd way, because Americans, Canadians, and Mexicans who are appalled and disgusted by NAFTA are uniting against corporatism. So in many ways, it's the capitalist world that's bringing about some sort of class cross-national class identification. But as far as economics goes, most Americans have no concept of it. It's just another word for unenlightened self-interest, in which the lowest price is a virtue. Taking advantage of other people is fair game, and labor rights, benefits, and other things that have to do with making people's lives better are deemed to be affronts to a person's pocketbook, which is why we have things like low taxes as a virtue. Nobody in America today talks about the need to raise income taxes on corporations, because corporate self-interest is now defined as a national self-interest.
Well, it's the opposite, Greg. Right now, Trump's people are plotting to lower taxes on corporations.
Well, of course, they're lowering taxes on corporations as opposed to raising them. Right
yes.
Now, there's very little difference in some areas between Republicans and Democrats. Like, you're not going to find any difference between a Republican and a Democrat on the matter of low taxes, because
it depends which Democrat. Bernie Sanders was quite different from the Republicans.
Well, Bernie Sanders is outside the mainstream of the Democratic Party.
But he would have won the election.
Be the mainstream.
He should have been the candidate and the president.
He was, because the Democratic Party cheated, and they
yes.
denied him proper respect, and the media cheated by not covering him properly.
That's right.
The whole election was designed to install Hillary Clinton in the White House to be Israel's sock puppet. But that failed because Hillary Clinton was unelectable and utterly unlikable.
Yeah, so I can't argue with any of that, Greg. I can't argue with any of that.
Good. That's great.
No, I couldn't have said it better. Yeah. So we only have about 1 minute left here, and we've kind of gone from Balfour and Zionism to the current situation in your book.
We did kind of get off topic. Maybe we can revisit this in a later show.
Right,
but I just want to remind people that The Host and the Parasite is in a third edition. It can be bought at thehostandtheparasite.com. And it still is, I think, in all modesty, the best description of how America degenerated and became a neo-fascist police state. It did so because it sold itself to the Israelis. The Israelis took it over, and to this day, we should no longer speak of America, but Isramerica, because Israel dictates policy, as we can see in the manner in which Donald Trump has repudiated whatever value he had as a candidate.
You know, I think your book got it right, and you were ahead of the curve. You know, today, as American police are being trained in ever greater numbers in Israel, taught to identify the American underclass as Palestinian subhuman vermin to be abused, it sure looks like Israel has something to do with the increasing, call it fascism or totalitarianism or whatever you want. So I think you're barking up the right tree, Greg, but unfortunately we hit the end of the hour, so we're going to have to bark again some other time.
Yeah, we'll have to make sure that Skype works next time. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, we're going to get this ironed out one way or another, by hook or by proverbial crook. Well, once again, thank you, Greg. It's been great. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Kevin.
Listen to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Sounds good.
Right back.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
That's Greg Felton. He's the author of The Host and the Parasite. I'm Kevin Barrett of truthjihad.com. Be back next week, same time, same channel, God willing, with a better Skype connection.
This is Rebel Cortex, looking for an answer it doesn't have.